This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, interesting characters, and engaging brains in sport. This episode's guest is a bit different for this podcast. A professional athlete, but not an elite competitor. A tattooed maverick with a mainstream following. Juliette Elliott is a former snowboarder, Vogue model, and bike courier who these days competes as a multidiscipline cyclist. She's also one of a growing breed of online influencers and YouTube stars who blogs, vlogs, and opens her life and love of sport to her fans around the world. Last December, she revealed another side of that life that she'd kept private until then, her difficulty in starting a family, her failed attempt at IVF, and ultimate adoption of her little girl, demonstrating, as if we needed reminding, that there's always so much more going on behind any happy, smiley Instagram post that we know nothing about. I wanted to chat to Juliette about her unconventional career approach, what it is to be living many kids' dream of being a YouTuber, what does that even mean, and how she's trying to open up discussion around adoption and unconventional families. This is When Orla Met, Juliette Elliott. Juliette, let's start again. We just started that conversation and I realised I wasn't recording. Can I excuse myself by saying I've got a 7-week-old child? Does that justify it in any way?
Yeah.
You're nodding, that'll do. I was asking you, Juliette, how you would describe yourself, because you wouldn't have heard my introduction to you, but the things you're known for are quite varied, very different, you know, across the board as well. How would you describe what you do, who you are?
I suppose the closest I would get nowadays would be to describe myself as a content creator, a blogger and a vlogger, also an ambassador. But these all kind of seep into one another, and just basically a cyclist, though, really.
And I mentioned in the bit that I didn't record, which no one will have heard, that you're here in London for a YouTube event. And YouTuber has become like a career aspiration these days, really, for kids, hasn't it? Is that something that you would describe yourself as well?
Well, I think the YouTube stuff just complements the other things that I do, although it does seem to have taken on a life of its own. And there are people that know me from YouTube rather than the other stuff I do. But I don't know, I just, at the most basic, I just always see myself as a cyclist rather than a YouTuber or anything. So it's more about using it as a platform to tell stories.
So how much of your job, your life these days is racing, riding, and how much of it is the other side of it, as in portraying all of that, the feeding the different platforms, whether it be Instagram, whether it be YouTube, whether it be any kind of ambassadorial role?
I mean, they're all sort of part of the same thing. Basically, everything I do on the bike is then part of the kind of content that I create, because the content I create is just me and my life. It's not like something made up. So I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Like, which feeds which, do you think? Does the social media side of it and the sponsor side of it feed the ability to ride your bike, or does riding your bike allow you the platform to be able to put yourself out there?
Well, without all the, you know, without riding my bike, then there would be no content, because the content is just my life and it's just what I do. So I always think the best thing that anyone can do is be themselves, because no one else can do that. So I just go ahead and do the stuff that I want to do anyway, and then I share those stories with people.
And the reason I'm asking, really, is because when we hear about people wanting to be YouTubers, it's such a, or an influencer, it's such a general, meaningless term, really, in itself. But people want the end result, rather than the process that goes into it and the lifestyle that goes into it, I guess, to make it genuine. Is that the key to it? Is it portraying your life rather than you being an influencer, for example?
Well, I think the most interesting people, certainly out of everyone that I follow, they're the people who are just telling you about their lives, you know, and there's not much more to it than that. I watch videos of people, I was watching one the other day, and it was this guy, and he's a bodybuilder, and it was him seeing what would happen if he ate the same diet as his toddler. I mean, it's like, I'm not into bodybuilding and I don't know this man, but he was just really interesting and funny, and this blog that was just about him going about his day-to-day life kind of got me hooked. So I think that's what works with YouTube and Instagram and all those sort of things. it allows you a little insight into someone's world, and that can be really interesting. I don't know, I'm waffling now.
Not at all. I'm intrigued by this bodybuilder. What happened then? What happened on the toddler diet? I might try this.
Well, it was pretty obvious what was going to happen. He ended up really, really hungry and then ate a huge burger. But the point is, I think the best content is just really genuine stuff. So stuff where you're just doing normal things that you do. And if you're an interesting person, then people will want to watch it. If you've got a story to... The thing is, it's not even are you an interesting person? It's have you got a story to tell? And I think everyone has got a story to tell. So
do they, though? That's the question. Because everybody is obviously on social media these days. And it is... it's just everywhere, and it's a prism through which a lot of people see the world and live the world. But the prism itself almost becomes the point for a lot of people. I mean, that's the danger, I guess. So I say danger, it's not a danger, but that's the downside, I guess, of social media as well, isn't it? That it becomes a point in itself.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you're saying. It can be annoying as well, for instance, you know, figuring out what you're going to put on Instagram and stuff rather than just having your dinner. But as jobs go, I wouldn't say it's too bad.
So that's a thing, actually, because is there that pressure for you to constantly be thinking of ways of portraying your life in an interesting way and in a way that is telling a story? Do you ever sit there and think, oh, I've actually got nothing to say today?
This sounds really bad, but no, not really, because I do a lot of stuff. So I'm always training and I'm always going on trips and racing and stuff. And so I don't really end up with not enough to say. Yeah.
What do you think of social media in general? And I don't mean people who are providing interesting content. I mean just the way that, as I was mentioning earlier, that it becomes this lens through which we see the world. I mean, I'm living in central Amsterdam at the moment, and I was laughing with my mother a few weeks ago because we're sitting next to this beautiful bridge, and I was watching this group of girls, maybe like early 20s, and there were five of them, and they spent 25 minutes on this bridge taking selfies and retaking selfies and doing different poses at different angles, and then looking at them, deleting them, doing the whole process. We live where we were sitting, it's in a UNESCO World Heritage site. There was so much to see, and instead of looking at a guidebook and absorbing the surroundings and allowing themselves to be inspired by it, they're documenting the moment rather than living the moment.
Yeah, that really sucks. And I'm so aware of that as well. And it spoils stuff for me, actually, sometimes, because I am obligated to document stuff sometimes, you know, for my sponsors. And I just want to enjoy the race. So as I've said before, it's not a bad job. I'm not truly complaining, but yeah, I do think social media can distract you from what's really going on, what's right in front of you. But yeah, I have really noticed that, and I am conscious of it. And I think doing things for social media rather than for yourself is, yeah, not the best way of going about it. Sometimes you just need to switch that off and enjoy what you're doing.
Do you get much or any negativity? I mean, your feeds are so positive, the videos are so positive, and lots of, well, everything that I've read from the comments that people make in reaction to it is, it's a lovely positive bubble, really. Do you get any of the negativity piercing through that?
Well, YouTube's a funny one. People do seem to be more okay with being mean in the comments on YouTube. I don't know what that is about. But basically, if someone's being really negative, I just delete their comment. I don't want that stuff on there. And in the past, it has got me down. You know, if someone says something particularly cutting. But I just have to remind myself that if this person were in a room with me and I didn't even know them or want to know them or care about them, why would I care what they think? Seriously, like... you can't go around wanting every single person to like you, and do you know what I mean? There's always going to be douchebags in the world, so just don't worry about it.
And that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, I have this sometimes with Twitter, whereby I'll get into what starts as a debate on Twitter, and then it becomes very personal, and I cannot step away from it in my head. I get really wound up, and then I think, this is basically like walking into a bar and having an argument with a drunk and staying there instead of walking out of the bar, which we wouldn't do in real life. It's not real. It intensifies everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had a discussion with Dave, my husband, about, you know, comments like that, because someone wrote something nasty and I replied and I said to him, he said, don't feed the trolls. You know, people want engagement with you. Do not do it. And I said, no, if this person said it to me in real life, I would defend myself. There is no way I would roll over and accept that. And he was like, yeah, but the more annoying thing to them is to have no response. So if you really want to win, you don't even reply and delete the comment and you move on with your life. So now I do that.
That's hard to do, though, isn't it? Because you do want to defend yourself and you do want to stick up for yourself and have your opinion out there as well, because they put it publicly.
Yeah.
But then obviously you're the one with the followers, they're not, and you're drawing attention to them by commenting on it, aren't you?
Yeah, basically. I mean, with Twitter in particular, you know, if you reply, then their stupid comment gets seen by everyone. Whereas if you don't, they're just shouting into a void.
But is that the hard bit of the job as well? Is that, I mean, I mentioned you've got, you know, your background in snowboarding, and you seem to have attitude to life whereby you just do what works at any given time. So you don't fit into any sort of conventional mold, I wouldn't say, but lots of what you do is essentially a popularity contest. You're looking for likes. You have to. You're looking for subscribers. You're looking for followers. That's what your brands who pay you money want, I guess.
Well,
you pulled a really like pained face when I said that.
The popularity contest thing, yeah, I know what you're saying, but I try never to think of it like that. And I just do what I'm doing. I just keep doing what I'm doing, and if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, okay, well then maybe I will have a rethink. But I never try to do stuff just for likes or whatever. I mean, yeah, like even with the titles of my videos, I hate that awful clickbait stuff. Like, GCN do it all the time, right? They put this... I love GCN. I might just say that now. But they do this...
Global Cycling Network, for anyone listening who hasn't heard of it before.
Yeah, I like watching GCN, right? But they do these awful clickbait titles where it's like, how to get up hills faster. And then you watch the video, and that's like a sentence at the end of it. I hate that when people just do clickbait. So I try not to do stuff just for clicks or likes or comments or whatever. I just try and do what I'm doing anyway, and if it works, cool. And if not, well, okay, whatever.
But you must be like the rest of us. You must post things and then check back on it and check the number of likes and check the comments. And I mean, it must be hard not to, for someone who is, as you say, obsessive, it must be hard not to obsess over that kind of thing.
I wouldn't say obsess over it, but I'd look, of course, I'm curious. But I just laugh about it mainly. Like, there's certain stuff that I post that I know no one is going to like, and I'll chuckle and think, well, who cares? It's my bloody Instagram account. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I do check, of course I do, but I don't get obsessed with it.
So you don't then, on YouTube, for example, look at the videos that are the most popular and think, I've tapped into something there, I need to recreate that?
No, actually, which apparently is really, really, really bad. So
I would have thought so.
So I went to a YouTube Women to Watch creator camp. They selected 20 women from around Europe to attend this camp, where they gave us lots of help, and there were panels with other women creators. It was really, really cool. Anyway, one of the presentations was all about YouTube analytics and how to interpret them and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, I've never even looked at them. And they were just like, oh my God, what? But that goes back to what I was saying earlier about how I really think it's better to just keep doing what you're doing and just, you know, present your real life. So I've always thought that going too deep into analytics and stuff would make you not be as honest. So I don't know.
So, I mean, it sounds like being a YouTuber, and I know you're not, and I'm using that as a very sort of lazy catch-all term, I guess, for this part of what you do, but it's serious business, you know? They coach you by the sounds of it. They give you, they bring you all together. They bring you as a network. They try to help you develop your craft within their platform. I mean, it's, they don't take it lightly, even though lots of the videos are fun and they look like you're doing it ever so naturally and organically. It is a business.
Yeah, and I think YouTube recognised the value of their creators, which is why they're supporting us. And, you know, the Women to Watch thing was great because it's specifically about something I really care about, you know, giving women a voice. And Yeah, the main thing I like about YouTube, aside from it being a business, is that it gives women who are underrepresented the chance to speak directly to their fans, you know. And there aren't enough women cyclists getting coverage. So to be able to just start your own channel and then, you know, broadcast what you're doing to other women and to men to show that we're doing all this cool stuff, I think it's really, really important.
So how do you go from just posting videos on YouTube to catching their eye and them taking you under their wing? How does that happen?
Well, you have to have a certain number of subscribers. So I think there was a minimum for the Women to Watch camp, I don't know what it was, 10,000 or something. I mean, I had about 25,000 subs at the time, and there was another woman with 80. So it's a broad range of people. But, you know, YouTube are very closely watching what we're all doing, and they can spot trends, you know, a million years before they happen. And they're on the hunt for people they can work with and support. So I guess, yeah, they just know what they're doing.
So is that a bit of a calling card? It's a bit competitive between yourselves as to who's got the most subs. You turn up at an event and somebody's an 80K-er and somebody else is a 20K-er.
Well, I don't think of it like that because we've all got different channels. So I can't compare myself to a gamer because gaming is huge, really, really, really massive. Maybe what I'm doing is more niche. I don't know. So I don't think it's a helpful comparison. But yeah, of course, everyone wants more subs.
You've got a daughter now, and I think for me anyway, whenever I have my first child, you become so much more aware of the world that they're growing up in and the world that they're coming into. How do you feel about the world of social media that your daughter will come into?
Ah, well, see, it's an interesting question given my job.
Yeah.
But in many ways, I kind of wish she didn't have to grow up with social media because I think it can be such a negative thing for young girls. I mean, my husband and I were discussing only the other day about smartphones. No way she's getting one. No way. She's having one of those old Nokia bricks until she's like 14 at least.
How do you square that circle then? Because you're obviously really comfortable with the medium. You seem to see it as a positive, or at least your contribution to it as a positive, and yet you don't want her to be exposed to it. How do you reconcile that?
Well, the problem is, it's not that I don't want her to be exposed to it all. There's a lot of really positive stuff. And like I said before, I think it's really important we have women telling their stories, you know. But the problem is, it's like the Wild West. It's not policed properly. And it's such an unknown new phenomenon that I don't think we all understand really all the implications. And I just, to me, it just doesn't feel safe for young girls. It's really hard to know what they're looking at. Well, and young boys, I'm not just talking about women. You don't know what they're looking at, and you don't know what... I mean, this cyberbullying really worries me, because how do you know if it's going on? And at least when we were at school, we could just go home and it stopped. I think the fact that all this stuff is, you know, they're constantly able to be bombarded with stuff that might not be positive, that's what worries me. There's heaps of positive stuff. I think social media is great for that. It's just, how do we filter out the bad stuff?
And some of the bad stuff isn't even the obvious. Like you're saying about the cyberbullying, that's something that can be specifically targeted, I guess, at least if you identify it's happening. But do you think that social media is also changing our perception of women in some ways, and what beauty is, and what... how women should be presenting themselves, and I guess young guys as well, because social media is a fantastic way in which to showcase strong women if you choose to look that way. But most of the young women on social media are more about the face tuning, and you know, everybody, you see people walking in the street now who look contoured as if they're supposed to be on Instagram, but in real life it just looks bizarre. But it's obviously a different version of beauty. Is that a worry as well for your daughter, that she will think that looks matter more, I guess?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we've always had images of beauty everywhere, you know, from, you know, painters to right through to fashion magazines. So I don't think it's a new thing that we're seeing images of beauty and that people aspire to that. I don't know if it necessarily... makes the problem even worse. I just think it's always been there.
But don't you think before it was a more of a distant problem, if a problem at all? I guess it was more of a
an aspiration that was very obviously an aspiration. You couldn't get there unless you looked like a model, you know, unless you were born that way. Whereas these days, we can all look a bit better. We could all, like, face tune. We could all whack a filter on an Instagram post.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose so. But I don't know. If everyone's doing it, then I don't know. I just don't know how I feel about it.
So I want to talk about your daughter, if that's okay, and your decision to start a family. Because one of the things about social media, we can all say, don't believe all the positive sides and all the nice bits on social media. There's lots that goes on in somebody's life away from all of that. And your story, I guess, is a complete case in point, because you're posting all this cool stuff on your various platforms. And then in December last year, said that actually while you were doing all of that, away from the posting about training and riding and sampling different products and whatnot, you had been undergoing IVF with your husband, and then a year of an adoption process.
Yeah.
So first of all, the IVF, why did you start on that journey, and what was that like for you?
Why do you think we started on that journey? Because we can't have kids, obviously. So we wanted a family. We've been trying for ages and it just wasn't happening. Went to the doctors and they suggested we try IVF, and we thought, well, give it a go. But yeah, it didn't work.
But I've never had IVF. I have friends who have. And because lots of people have had it, or lots of people have it these days, it becomes more normalized. But by all accounts, it's a pretty difficult thing to have to go through.
It's horrific. It's the worst thing I've ever done. Like, physically even, as well as emotionally. We had to set an alarm for 5 in the morning, and Dave would have to get up and give me this enormous injection in my bum. Like, this thing was so thick, it was like a pencil. And he just feels so mean having to stab his wife in the bum, do this. And then I had to go and have all these blood tests and stuff. The bum thing was the worst thing, though. It was like mega, mega painful. Even sitting down was painful after that.
And I imagine you've got quite high pain thresholds.
Yeah, totally. You know, we've got tattoos and stuff like that. So I'm kind of used to dealing with stuff, but that was horrible. It's pretty horrible. But what kept me going throughout it all, really, was cycling. You know, like, I was still racing, and people might think that's mad, you know, give your body a break. But that's what kept me sane, you know, carrying on riding my bike. The absolute lowest point was when, during our second round of IVF, the doctor said I couldn't ride my bike. I mean, at all. Like, because I'd been riding it to and from my appointments, and he was like, no cycling.
Why?
Oh, I don't know. It was really extreme, you know. I mean, we listened to him because we wanted to try everything to, you know, the full extent of, you know, we wanted to know that we'd done everything we possibly could. So he said no baths, no, I mean, obviously you can still have a shower. I didn't just totally stink. But no baths and no cycling, and I had to drink like 4 litres of water a day or something. So I was literally running between toilets the entire time. But yeah, that was the lowest point, when he said no cycling, because throughout the whole thing, you know, I'd still been racing Red Hook Crit and stuff. And that kept me feeling like a new normal human being rather than just some sort of baby vessel.
Well, I was going to ask how long that whole cycle lasts for, because that must be what you feel like. You're just consumed by that and dedicated to that. And if you're not even allowed to ride your bike, you've got nothing else. You're just waiting for your body to do what it's going to do and hope that it turns out okay.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks. I don't know how people cope if they haven't got something else that they're really passionate about, because obviously you obsess about the treatment too. It's impossible not to, but having something else really, really helps.
So how long did you have to not ride your bike for?
Oh, that was, this was only like a month. I'm not saying like it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, but it was just like the final straw. It's like, I've tried so hard and now you're taking the one thing that gives me pleasure away from me.
And also, a month can be a very long time when you don't know what the outcome's going to be and you don't know how long that's going to last for. Did you know that it was going to be a month? Was that a set period or?
Yeah, I knew, because of the way they do the cycle, the way they time it and all the drugs that they're giving you. So yeah, that month sure did drag on, particularly as I was getting up at 5 a.m. all the time. It sucked.
So what made you stop with the IVF then? Why did you both go, that's enough?
Well, we did 2 cycles, and after the second one, I just, it, I mean, I just can't even describe how traumatic the whole thing was. It was just awful, you know. And then, you know, just the sort of intrusive, you know, invasion of privacy when it comes to implanting embryos and stuff like that. And then the actual pain, you know, and it was just so full on. I didn't want to go through it again. And also, I didn't want to get my hopes up again and have them dashed. I just wanted to be done with it and to know where I was because, you know, life had been filled with uncertainty for so long. I just wanted to have some certainty back in my life. It's like, okay, that is not working. I'm not doing that again. We're going to come up with another plan. So that's what we did.
And on your blog, when you announced that this was how your family had been created, you said that the adoption process itself was actually incredibly difficult. What was that like?
Well, it goes on for quite a long time and it's very full on. You have to fill out this really, 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 really long document that's like doing a dissertation. Dave and I were actually in Barcelona for Red Hook Crit at the time. So we were doing it on an iPad in between going to all these cool events and stuff. But it's like this full on document all about your history, your parents' history, your family history, your passions, dislikes, your parenting style, any traumatic experiences, just it's like everything that's ever happened to you. Then after that, a social worker starts coming to your house every week for 2 hours for 10 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, and they interview you intensively. I mean, it's fair enough. They've got to get it right, right?
Yeah.
But it's full on. And then you know, have to have a full physical, and some of it feels quite unfair.
Well, I was going to say, if you did a physical test, we don't test biological parents for their fitness to parent, which is probably the sad thing about it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff like the physical felt pretty mean, you know, having your breasts felt for lumps and stuff, because they didn't want to place a child with you if you were going to get cancer and things like that. I don't know, like, but you
oh my
just,
God, that's horrific.
Yeah, if you've gone through IVF, then you can deal with anything. And you thing with adoption is, you know, at the end of it, you're going to get something. So you just put up with it. With IVF, you might not get anything. So that's really hard. With adoption, it's like, okay, we'll do this, we'll do that. We'll jump through hoops, we'll do everything you want. Because at the end, we get a kid.
Did you have any doubts before going on the adoption process? I mean, lots of people want to biologically have their own children and maybe and are unsure about adoption and whether they can love somebody else's child as much. Were there any of those doubts, or did you have any doubts at all?
Well, this is going to sound like a really silly analogy, maybe, but we did discuss that, my husband and I, and he said to me, how much you love the cats. You know, because I'm crazy about the cats, obviously. And he's like, how much you love the cats? You're crazy about them. Did you give birth to them? And I was like, no, good point. And he's like, well, what about me? Did you give birth to me? And I was like, well, no, that'd be really weird. And I just thought that was a really simple way of, you know, thinking about it. And of course you don't have to give birth to someone to love them. Of course you don't. So that made things a lot clearer for me.
So it was about a year, was it, before you found out that you were successful as adoptive parents?
Well, it was about a year before our daughter moved in, yeah.
And how did you meet her? How were you put together? Did you or her, or what kind of say did you have over it?
Well, the reason the social workers come around so much and talk to you so much is so they know you intimately and they're able to pair you with a child who would be a good match. Dave and I are both quite extrovert and quite outdoorsy, and so they would try and pair you with a child that would that you'd get on with, basically. So we didn't have any say in it at all. They sent us a written profile of the child, which is only a few sentences long. And with that being a baby, you know, there's not really much they could say, is there? They were like, well, she likes cheese and she doesn't like Marmite. Would you like to, you know, to proceed? And the thing is, like, if you want a child and you've wanted one for so long, well, of course you want to proceed. And how could you not love any little child that needs a home? How could you not love them? So we didn't go and pick, you know, we were paired with a little girl, and once we said we were interested in her profile, we got a tiny, tiny little passport photo, and they check again, do you still want to proceed? I mean, you're not going to say no then. No, I've changed my mind. I don't like the photo. Of course you're not going to say that. We were like, yes, we want to proceed. And We met her 2 weeks before she moved in with us.
It's really intense.
Yeah, it's full on. I mean, you do have a thinking day in the middle of the second week of introductions, where you have a day off and you don't go and meet each other and you have some time to think, is this what we want to do? But yeah, of course it's what we wanted to do. She's wonderful.
And how much did they tell you about her background and why she was in a position to be adopted? How much did you know about all of that beforehand? And were you worried, I guess, about what her life had been like so far?
They tell you everything. That is one thing you do get info on. You get all the family history. So we're fully aware of everything she's been through and the implications of that.
And is that something that you'll be discussing with her? I mean, I don't know if that's something that you've talked about or are going to talk about, or if that's something that you're deciding to keep private, which would be completely understandable.
Well, when she's a bit older, then we'll talk to her about all that. But right now, we're just letting her be.
And why did you decide then to be open about how she came into your lives and to chat about the fact that she'd been adopted?
Well, basically, people started asking friends about who's this little girl in Dave's video, because he would just show like the back of her head and stuff like that. And then I even got messages from friends in America saying, oh, people asked me about your daughter and I didn't know if I was allowed to say anything, you know, because obviously my close friends knew. So I hadn't decided that I was going to share any news, because actually I find it really annoying when people just post photos of their kids on social media. It's like, I follow you. I'm interested in you. I'm not interested in your kid. Anyway, so I wasn't sure I even wanted to share anything. But I think the thing was, I ended up being really excited by her being in our life, and it became such a big part of it. And I thought, well, I want to be able to share stuff like everyone else does. Why should I not be allowed to? Because of the way our family was created. And then I discussed it with Dave, and we kind of thought, well, it makes it seem like there's something wrong with the way our family came into being, or there's something wrong with her and she's not allowed to be seen. And that seemed kind of unfair. And I also thought that opening up conversations about these things can be so helpful to people. You know, we talk a lot more about mental health now, and I know that has a good effect and makes people feel less alone and helps, you know, it's like a snowball effect. So I thought, you know, I'd like to get that, to open up that dialogue and share everything I've been through. Maybe it'll help some other people and, you know, make their less stigma, I suppose, as well. So, yeah, Dave and I discussed it at length and decided that it was the right thing to do.
And you've had a really positive feedback to that. Lots of people saying that maybe they've been through a similar situation, or, you know, again, opening up that dialogue, being more open. That then, I guess, is a bit of responsibility for yourself as well, because you're reading these posts. I guess you feel obliged to reply to them and be part of that other network now as well.
Yeah, I mean, since then I've had several phone calls with people who are going through IVF or considering adoption. They've reached out to me through my website or through social media and said, you know, my wife and I, or my husband and I, are in the same situation as you are. I really don't know anything about adoption, because it's actually quite hard to get decent information about it. They're like, would you have 10 minutes for a phone call? So I say yes, and like an hour and a half later we're still chatting.
But is that hard? Because you don't want to say no to people, because you understand their situation, you've been there, you know how difficult it is, but you need time for yourself. You need to be able to protect some of your own private time as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much time to myself. I am pretty all go all the time, but I feel like Dave and I were really fortunate in that some close friends of ours were adopting right before we did it, so we had that inside line to what's going on, and that really it was so valuable to us. So I just feel like, sorry for people who don't have that, and I feel that I'm in a position where I can help, so why wouldn't you?
So how long has she been with you now, and how's it going?
I haven't added up the months. I guess 8 months or so, and it's just the best thing ever, 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 ever. This morning, I was sat on my walk bike upstairs, and she was outside the window with Dave on the back of it, on his bike seat. And so I shouted out the window, bye, and her little face looked up, and she's like, mommy, 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 mommy. And she's, it's just wonderful. It's the best thing we've ever done.
It's hard though as well, isn't it? I mean, I've just had a baby 7 weeks ago, and At least I get to adjust to each of the hard bits as they come. But to be almost thrown into parenting head first, that's quite an upheaval of your lives, I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I love her very much, but the first few months were, oh my God, so hard. So hard. Like the first couple of weeks in particular, you know, we had no idea what we're doing. And then you just question everything you're doing. And we were really lucky because her foster family are very, very nice and very up for staying involved with us. So we would ask them for advice, and that was really helpful. But yeah, it's just, you are thrown in at the deep end, and it's pretty crazy. But on the other hand, you know, I don't think any parent knows what they're doing. Do they the first time?
No. First time, second time, every single day, I have no idea what I'm doing. But then that, I am a bit rubbish.
So I just remembered that. It's like, you're not born knowing how to look after children. You have to learn as you go along, right? So it's the same, really.
And I find you're usually learning a day after you were supposed to. So they've done something. The next day you think, oh, I know how to handle that now. But then they've moved on to the next thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how would you feel if your daughter then, if it were all to come full circle and she were to say to you, Mummy, I'd like to make a career in social media or through YouTube or through doing the things that you're doing?
I'd say go for it, you know. I think you've got to support your children and let them chase their dreams. My parents have always supported what I do, and I'm so lucky, and that's really helped me strive for what I want. It's given me the confidence to go for it. So yeah, I would support her all the way.
So what's next for you? You snowboarder, Vogue model, bike courier, musician. Where next? Oh, actually, I read as well you used to play in a string quartet in an orchestra.
That was so long ago, did you?
What did you play?
Oh, that was when I lived up in Derbyshire, yeah. So I played down in Alfreton and, yeah, around there.
Did you play, what, violin or viola?
Yeah, second.
So, second violin. Yeah. I like how you qualify that. But I mean, oh, I just had a terrible pun come to my head. I mean, there are so many strings to your bow. You've done, that's good, isn't it? You have done so much with such success. Where does that intense attention span take you next?
Well, I just want to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm really happy right now. And I think that I don't need anything else. You know, I have a really cool job, a husband and a family, a nice house, a small house. I quite like a garage, actually. Here's me saying I don't need anything else. I'd really like a garage. That's about it. I'm happy, you know. I just want to keep doing what I'm doing. That's what I want.
And tonight you're at this YouTube event. What does that involve?
YouTube are doing a special event for International Women's Day. So they commissioned a film with four female creators, all from different realms, you know. So I'm the sports one, there's a gamer, other stuff like that. And the film is all about, it's called S for Stereotype. I don't want to swear on your podcast. I don't swear on my videos. So it's all about how, you know, women can deal with coming up against stereotypes and, you know, personal experiences and inspirational panels from other cool women they've invited along. So quite looking forward to seeing the film they've made. I haven't actually met the other influencers that they've used for that because they just filmed me all on my own. So it should be a good opportunity to go along and get inspired and meet some new people and make some new friends.
Is that important to you, to F the stereotype?
What's important to me is to do what I want and not let gender have anything to do with it. So if that means effing the stereotype, then I suppose, yeah.
Just before we go, I completely forgot to ask you about all your tattoos. How many do you have?
I have no idea how many I have. I've never counted them.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
Most people I meet with tattoos use that as a badge of honour, that how many they've got.
Oh, I
maybe
just...
one day.
You know what? People ask me about them and the significance, and I'm like, yeah, they're just whatever. It's just a decoration. There's no deep and meaningful.
You just like how they look.
Yeah, I haven't had any for ages now because I can't decide what I want, and they're quite expensive. And as I've got older, they've started to hurt more. So yeah, nothing deep and meaningful there.
Any that you regret?
Oh, well, I've got a half-finished one that's enormous, and the guy that did it has moved to New York now, and he's become really successful and really, really expensive. So it's never going to get finished, and I'd kind of just rather not have half a tattoo. So I'd get rid of that one.
Surely if he started it, he would finish it though, no?
He would, but I would have to fly to New York at great expense. And plus, it's so old now that all the new work would look really weird on it.
So what is it? What's the half tattoo? Where is it?
It's on the side of my abdomen, and it's a wolf and loads of sort of fleur-de-lis kind of vines and bits and bobs like that.
And you've got, am I right in thinking you've got hell tattooed inside your lip, and your friend has got How did that come about?
Oh, well, we were in New York riding our bikes, actually, and it was just one of those impulsive things. I think we'd probably been drinking.
I was going to say.
Yeah, there's probably booze involved. And yeah, we just kind of fancied getting something to commemorate the trip.
Can I see it?
Yeah, here.
Oh! Oh my God, was that not really painful? Or were you drunk when you got it done as well?
Well, when I say we'd had a couple of drinks, I mean genuinely, it was only a couple of drinks. I wasn't that drunk, but excuse me. It's over so quickly, so it didn't really hurt. It hurt afterwards. You're like, oh, what have I just done? But it's over so quickly that you don't even notice.
You've got the quite scary half of the hell, yeah. When you lower your lip like that and I see the hell inside it, it looks quite badass.
Oh, thank you.
Juliet, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
No worries. It's been great.
Juliet is one of those rare, disarming characters who's so energizing to talk to. Her appetite for life is insatiable, and her natural ability to just make sport cool for girls, for women, is a rare talent. It's no wonder brands have wanted to tap into that for as long as she's been doing sport. And I can only admire her desire to speak about the adoption process and how hard it's been for her and her husband. Becoming a parent any which way is no easy thing, and I'm pretty sure her little girl will grow up knowing she's very lucky to have the mum and the dad that she has. Thank you to Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode of When Orla Met. If you've missed any of the episodes so far, they're all available to download. And to not miss any of the chats still to come, make sure you subscribe. Leave a review as well if you like. It does make a difference, believe it or not. And if you want to get in touch, then follow me on Instagram or on Twitter @WhenOrlaMet.